Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota in Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit Toyota on nicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at lexusoflexington.com. Did you know that half of America is single? Hollywood has never produced anything like this before. The Dating Project, a groundbreaking documentary that follows five single people, ages 18 to 40, as they search for authentic and meaningful relationships. There is no script. There are no actors. These are real people trying to find love and happiness in an age of swiping left or right. From Empower Pictures, Paulist Productions, Family Theater Productions, and PureFlix, you can now own The Dating Project. Save the date by visiting thedatingprojectmovie.com and go a step further and help others in your circle date differently by partnering with Ascension Press. Visit shop.ascensionpress.com to acquire the companion study guide. The Dating Project movie is now available on DVD and digital download on Amazon, iTunes, and Walmart. Please visit thedatingprojectmovie.com for details.
Good evening, my fellow truth seekers. Welcome to Beneath the Surface here at WCAP Radio, 980 on your dial, where faith and reason meets every Monday evening between 10 and 11 p.m. Glad you could join us tonight as we bring a little sanity into our age of insanity, a little life into our culture of death. Well, tonight, my fellow truth seekers, tonight we delve beneath the surface on the question of what is beauty? What is beauty? We use the word often, not sure if we've ever articulated a definition to ourselves. What is beauty? Is it simply subjective? Is it beauty is simply that which pleases the individual? Or is beauty an objective quality? And if the latter, then what is the standard measurements of beauty? Well, to help us out with this discussion is you, our listeners, as well as the guy right in front of my face. There he is, the beautiful one, Mr. Kent Niebuhr.
I was just going to say how ill-equipped I am to, how ironic it is.
That, well, you're certainly not illustrating.
Ironic it is that I would be asked to speak on the topic of beauty.
Yes. A face for radio, they say.
That's right. I have a face for radio. So.
No, actually, you're not. Speaking of beautiful, there is our normal, regular, weekly,
beautiful,
not co-host, but producer.
Yeah.
Miss Cindy.
Hi. How you doing?
I can't complain. Cindy, you have a show after ours.
Yep, Cindy's Vinyl Vault. It's going to be a good show. Make a request after 11 o'clock.
Making a request after 11 o'clock, so find out what's in her vaults. A lot of good things.
You know, I don't know if I ever determined or I was ever informed of what are the parameters for Cindy's Vinyl Vault. Is there an era, a particular era, or is there a cutoff?
Yeah, so Cindy, why don't you define what the vault entails?
Music from the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Okay.
There you go.
All right.
See, my one-man band's musical gig is music from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So
you just took a little step.
Cindy's Vinyl Vault is a decade behind me.
Now, you know, it's funny because when I realized that as a kid, quote-unquote oldies were from the 50s, and this was the 70s, when I realized that the music of my youth, my teenage years were the 80s, and that, you know, in the first decade of the 21st century, that those songs were just as old.
Those the as yeah, the those would oldies. Be considered oldies.
Right. So if there's a 20-year sort of
isn't that
left,
unbelievable?
I was as old as my parents.
But
basically.
I tell you what, when you were listening to music, your parents' music and culture were like another world.
They
were another
they
universe.
They were very foreign.
Yeah,
very,
very foreign, like another country. You didn't understand at all why they would even listen to that stuff.
Sure, yeah.
Today, kids listen to the exact same things that we listened to growing up.
You know, I have to.
What's the deal with that?
I have to.
As Seinfeld might say.
I have to tell you, I'll illustrate this and then I'll give you my hypothesis on this.
All right.
The illustration is about a year ago, my wife and I chaperoned a high school dance.
Okay.
And I want to say that at least 30% of the songs at this high school dance were from the 80s.
At least 30%.
At least 30%. This is actually, this was earlier this year. It was February. Yeah. So at least 30% of the songs were from the 80s.
Well, you and I went to a wedding recently.
We did.
And I'd have to say 90% of the songs were like from the 80s and 90s. Wouldn't you? Or something,
I don't know if
something
I'd say
similar?
90, but it was striking.
The 70s, too.
How many? Because I'm thinking these people who are teenagers and in their early 20s now are as familiar with dozens, I guess, or at least a couple of dozen.
The bride and groom that we're talking about are in their very early 20s.
Very early.
And here they are. They chose music that were from the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Exactly.
80 to 90%.
Yeah, and more recent songs, too. But there was such a huge proportion.
Yeah.
That were,
and they knew the songs better than perhaps
at
we
least
did.
At least as well as we did.
At least
yeah,
as well.
it was jarring.
Right,
now,
I
here's
have,
my theory on it, though.
And I have a theory, too. So
all right.
And by the way, this does indirectly relate to our topic tonight.
Doesn't
it?
Theory does.
It's not just a tangent. But go ahead. What's yours?
All right. Tangent literally means touching. Did you know that?
Well, it's tangible. I suppose it would be touching.
Yeah.
Okay.
So my theory is this. The music from the 50s to the 70s changed a lot. So as you said a few minutes ago, it seemed very foreign. It seemed like another world. And when you think about it, when you know our parents were listening to their music, we'll call it, in the 50s, the previous 20 years, you're going back to the 30s. So you're talking about, you know, crooners. You're talking about Benny Goodman, maybe, right?
You are.
Big band. All of that stuff,
you
right?
Are.
Which is also equally foreign from the 30s to the 50s, from the 50s to the 70s.
I actually think from the 30s and 40s music is much different than 50s music.
Yes.
Like
I agree.
A world of
That's
difference.
My point. It's so different. But when you go from 70s to 90s, it's a little different.
Yes.
When you go from the 80s to the first decade.
21st century,
Right, to the 21st century, it's not very different. Once you hit the 80s to the present,
that is
music
correct.
Has changed
now,
a little,
okay,
but
so what
barely.
What you're doing is you're giving me a descriptive of this. Now I'm going to give you a theory. And I understand. You described it well. No, there's no question about it.
So what I'm saying.
The question is why?
And why has music changed so little?
And here is what I'm going to give you.
All right.
I don't think it's only music. If you look at movies and television shows, what are they all doing in the past decade? They're going back to older ideas.
They've reached a bottom.
They reached a bottom a while ago, and now they're going back to cartoon comic book characters and superheroes.
Recycling things.
And even movies that were good, they're doing them over again.
Yes.
One, two, three sequels.
Yep.
We've been doing this for a couple of decades now, and I think that we have been less and less creative as a society since we have become a post-Christian society. I think creativity and spirituality go together hand in hand.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a few years ago, one of my favorite all-time actors died, and Peter O'Toole. And shortly before he died, he was on the Charlie Rose show, and Charlie Rose said, tell me what you... So Peter O'Toole was in a lot of movies, but he got his start in the theater, and he did theater all his life. And Charlie Rose said to him, "Tell me the state of the theater today." And he looked at him ironically, and he said, "Charlie, the theater is dead." He said, "There is no theater anymore. There's rehashings of movies. There's no creativity in theater." This was Peter O'Toole's take on it.
Interesting.
I tend not to disagree with him, but it's really not my realm. I can't really speak
theater
on the theater.
Arts. See, the theater is an art, obviously. Mm-hmm. I would say all of the arts have been very stagnated and stale.
I was going to use that word, too.
Stagnated mm-hmm. and stale.
Yep.
And people are just going backwards.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I think what happened is it ties into what you said. As yes. soon as art deviates from the transcendent, right,
yes.
from the things that are perfections,
yeah.
right, that are ideals, that yeah. are that are what we ought to be striving for, that mm. are that are calling to calling us to the best, better part of ourselves, the best part of ourselves, the best part of, even if it's not something that we possess in much degree, that we know instinctively, let's say.
We strive for.
That.
We yearn for.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, so what happens is once you turn away from the transcendent, from
yeah.
all those ideals, what you're left with is basically animalism, I
yeah.
would say. So things that just simply feel good, or things that simply give physical type of pleasure or emotional pleasure, which physical pleasures and emotional pleasures are not in themselves bad. They're wonderful things,
mm.
right? They're supposed to be part of our existence.
Yes.
But when we detach them from the transcendent ideals,
mm.
we're left with
okay, so
empty
basically,
pleasure.
Basically what you're saying is we're more than animals, and that dimension of us that is more than animals is personhood. And personhood is spiritual.
Transcendent.
And spiritual transcends the physical and the physiological
mm-hmm.
dimension of us. And that needs to be fed. If that's not fed,
yep.
then our nature is not fulfilled, and we're stagnated, and we sort of run around and try to catch our tail like a dog would do.
Sure. I was having a conversation with a young man in his early 20s just a couple days ago, Sunday, and he said, actually, that would be yesterday, wouldn't it? and he said that part of his experience, it was that, you know, he was raised in a religious family, and they went to Mass every Sunday, and he was confirmed and all the Catholic sacraments. But he said it never meant anything to him. He wasn't conscious of any depth whatsoever of the Catholic faith. And he just essentially pursued what you think adolescents normally pursue, you know, as we used to say when we were kids, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, right? So, and what he ended up happening, thankfully, in not too many years, he realized the sort of emptiness of this. He realized that this was a dead end. He realized that he was spiraling downwards. And what he supplanted it with was silence, contemplation. And this is what got him out of this downward spiral.
Yep.
So the world is always trying to fill our ears. I mean, look at iPods, right? We're always supposed to have our earbuds in our ears, mm. pumping something into our heads, generally music,
yeah.
if not politics. Or
the more that our sensors are overloaded, the yeah. less that our spirits can soar.
Exactly. The more we can
yeah.
be contemplative.
Yeah.
We can think about, say, the lyrics we're listening to, or say we're listening to talk radio. We can think about the conversation, but can we be reflective, right? Can we really look inside ourselves and pursue some ideal?
Aristotle calls contemplation the highest form of happiness that a human being can endeavor.
Yeah, but contemplation of what? Your navel? Like people always
contemplation
right?
of eternal things.
Exactly.
Is what he says.
Of the of yeah. as Plato would say, the ideals, the perfections, mm. right? the sort of sources of all the things which we recognize are good.
978-454-4980 is our phone number, the BTS hotline. 978-454-4980 if you want to get involved in our conversation. We'd love to have you. Tonight's topic is the question, what is beauty? My guest is Mr. Kent Niebuhr. And I'm Paul Morano, and again, you're listening to Beneath the Surface.
So, Paul, I want to tell you an interesting anecdote about when I was a kid. My first...
I'm laughing because I can't get any questions out here. You're just... You are such a yakker.
Okay,
it's incredible.
I'll take the first half of the show. You take the second half.
Go ahead. Tell me about your story. Go ahead.
So, this was the first time in my life where I was sort of forced to contemplate the concept of beauty. I realized that... I had known these girls who attracted my attention because of their physical beauty.
Okay.
And some of them, the more I got to know them, the uglier they became to me because of who they were, not how they looked.
Yeah.
And at about that time, this was 10th grade, I met a girl who was not physically attractive to me at all, but we were in the same class. It was a shop class, and we would work on projects. She was sort of, you know, sat next to me, and we worked together on these projects. Not attractive to me at all. In fact, I would have said I thought she was ugly.
Okay.
The more I got to know this girl, the more beautiful she became.
Mm.
So what it tells you is that beauty cannot merely be superficial.
The thing is, when you talk about human beings, you're not talking about an object.
Right.
See, everything else, you can say the physical dimension of this object is beautiful, therefore it's beautiful.
A statue. Yeah. We call a statue beautiful,
a statue,
not because of
or even a house or even a mountain or even an
a
animal.
A view, a tree.
Tree. Mm-hmm. When it comes to human beings, there's something else to take into account when you judge its beauty.
Right.
And it's their personhood.
A depth of beauty, which is not simply on the surface.
Let's get down to the nitty-gritty here. With the question, do you believe that beauty is subjective or objective? In other words, is beauty simply in the eye of the beholder? Or is it an adherence to some kind of natural order?
My answer is not going to satisfy you, but I'm going to say it's both.
Oh, that totally satisfies.
Okay. And here's why I would say that.
Tell us.
I would say that depending on my... You could say psychology, or I'm more inclined to say my moral state. Depending on how corrupt my soul, my mind, my heart is, my psyche, I might recognize beauty to a greater or lesser degree.
Okay.
Right? For instance, an alcoholic might see a bottle of whiskey and say, that's beautiful.
Sure.
Right?
Right.
However... there is beauty that's seems to be undeniable universally.
Undeniable universally.
Yeah.
Which means that it is objective, it's independent of our opinions and perceptions.
If you mean by perceptions something subjective, I would say yes. But if you mean by perceptions our ability to see it or recognize it, I think there's a subtlety there that might distinguish it from simple subjectivity.
Let me quickly ask you a question before the break then. Is it possible to say that the planet Neptune is beautiful even if we've never seen it before? Even if nobody has perceived it, is it possible to surmise that it might be beautiful?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I tell you what, we're going to delve more into this question of objective versus subjective beauty. And I have a few thoughts myself. You're listening to Beneath the Surface here at WCAP. Paul Morano here with my guest this week, which is Mr. Kent Niebuhr. Be back right after this quick break. And we're back. 978-454-4980 is our phone number. You're listening to Beneath the Surface on WCAP Radio. Glad you could join us. Cindy, behind the glass, do you know that live streaming is working tonight?
You know what? I have no idea
about
that part of the station.
Rumor that I'm getting right now is that it's not working. And there's no way of listening to the show on the computer. Is that you don't know of any idea?
from what I heard, we're having a little bit of an issue. I'm not sure who can fix it, but it's we're gonna be working on that.
Okay, so, but I can get a podcast from the show.
Oh yeah.
Okay. All right. So.
You know, I give those to you, and you put them online.
Yes, indeed. So you can listen to us live on the radio right now, and as soon as we get the podcast from the show, we'll put it on facebook.com/fellowtruthseekers, which is my Beneath the Surface webpage that has all my podcasts on it, facebook.com/fellowtruthseekers. Okay, so we're back here. We're talking about the question of beauty with my guest, Mr. Kent Niebuhr. And before the break, I asked him whether beauty is objective or subjective, and he said both. There's an element of both. Now, Kent, the subjective is relatively easy. This pleases you aesthetically, therefore you consider it beautiful. I look at the same thing, I might not, so I don't think it's beautiful. That's a subjective thing. And of course, we all have our different tastes regarding art and beauty around the world. Tell me, if you can articulate it, what might be objective about beauty?
The extent to which it captures reality, truth. So, because, think of it this way, this ties into what we were saying earlier, if you live your life according to a lie, your life is going to be an ugly life. if art is a misrepresentation of reality.
Yeah.
It's ugly. If it's an accurate representation, it's beautiful.
Same thing with language?
St. Thomas Aquinas said, even if what is depicted in art is ugly, if it's an accurate depiction of ugliness, it's beautiful art. The example that I came across was Medusa, the Greek demigod, I guess, who was basically turned to a serpent. She still had her sort of upper body, torso, face was that of a woman, but she had serpents for hair and a serpent tail, I guess, for a body.
Okay.
And so there are these fantastic, beautiful representations of Medusa that are highly skilled works of art. However, what they're depicting is ugliness, but they capture ugliness that it's a beautiful work of art in that sense.
Yes.
So if it accurately depicts reality, even though Medusa is not a real creature, if it accurately depicts reality, it's beautiful.
Okay, so art, if it depicts reality, it's beautiful. How about in natural things, not artifacts?
Yeah.
How does one measure beauty as an objective measurement? If we're not depicting anything, would it be simply the pristine nature of that being?
You know, I would say that it's something along those lines. In other words, if a tree, right? A tree is a healthy tree. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
When a tree is diseased or it's been wounded or something like that, its beauty is compromised.
Yes.
Which is also... there's something there that tells us something about ugliness. So if the tree is diseased or somehow altered, mauled, let's say, its beauty is missing, right? So in other words, the concept is ugliness the opposite of beauty, or is it the absence of beauty?
And you could say that it's both.
Yeah.
The opposite is the absence of.
Yeah.
Right? I mean...
Right.
So just like evil is the absence of good, ugliness is the absence of beauty.
Right. And that which we call evil is the absence of
So we're on to something here. It seems like if evil is the absence of good and ugly is the absence of beauty, and we could add one more, of course, falsehood is the absence of truth.
Yeah.
Then... being itself is truth, goodness, and beauty.
Right.
And the privation or the diminishment of being leads to less truth, less goodness, and less beauty, or falsehood,
right,
lies, and ugliness.
So as we stray from one, we stray from the others. Yeah. As we neglect,
they're all related.
Right. As we neglect one, the rest, our grasp on the others is compromised. So if we mistake beauty, if we get beauty wrong, we also get truth and goodness wrong. Mm. And that goes for each of them the same.
Okay. There is a standard definition or thought relating to beauty out there, and that is symmetry. Scientists have said that most people think beautiful, even though it varies in various cultures, symmetry is something that seems to be in common. Symmetry of the face, of the person, of the body.
Even a tree, right?
Even or a tree.
It's something in nature. If it has that sort of balance, that symmetry, it seems perfect, right?
Yeah.
Whereas things that are, I don't know, if I shaved one side of my head and let the hair on the other side of that head grow long or just...
It would be unique, but it wouldn't be symmetric.
Right. It might be interesting. It might be meaningful. It might be any of these things. But I don't know that anyone would call it beautiful. I don't know if that would be in the Beehive. Now, they might say you're beautifully expressing some point or some feeling or some concept.
Right.
But that hairstyle itself, I don't think would be categorized as beautiful. And this gets to your point about symmetry. If it's not symmetrical, things like that are not usually called beautiful. And think about this, just like in engineering, right? A car has to be symmetrical to be effective. A car that's not... This is why, what do? When we get new tires, we have to have them aligned.
Aligned and balanced.
There has to be symmetry, right?
Yes.
And think about structures, right? Architecture. If there's not a balance, if weight is not equally distributed, it's going to fail. Could an airplane fly if it were not symmetrical?
And it's interesting how we have two of so many things physically.
Two eyes, two nostrils, two ears.
Why don't
we have three? Why don't we have two nostrils on each side instead of just two?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it's funny. We don't have two noses, but we do have two nostrils.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the nose is just...
I'm looking at you right now, and I'm seeing two.
Analyzing my twos.
I'm seeing two of a lot of things right now.
Yeah, right.
Ears, eyes, eyebrows,
and think
nostrils.
Of your teeth, right? You don't have, you know, 20 on one side and 19 on the other.
And
right?
They're up and down. They're two sets of teeth in
top
a, in
and
a
bottom.
Sense.
Right. Yeah.
So there's something about a natural order of the individual is symmetric.
Right.
And what about a natural order of the community? Isn't there something beautiful about a natural order?
Well, think about this.
Yeah.
When you talk about a community, I think of the smallest community that I think of is a man and a woman.
Yes.
And think of the complementarity there that I guess I'm stretching the word a little bit, but that's a kind of symmetry, right?
I think so.
The complementarity of man and woman is a beautiful thing, right? So when you think of a society, you have men and women, whether the society is a marriage or whether the society is a town or something like that. Boys and girls, men and women.
And there's a certain beauty and a certain order to that beauty that makes it true, good, and beautiful.
Sure. And why aren't there three sexes? Right? Why aren't there nine?
Right.
Right? There are two.
There are two.
Right? There's symmetry in that complementarity as well.
978-454-4980. Is our Beneath the Surface hotline. If you want to give us your two cents on the meaning of beauty, we're all ears.
Now, I have a question.
And we have two of them.
I have a question
to listen
to you,
Paul. Yes. What do you got?
When you think of what was the ideals of beauty throughout the ages, you know, we have this phrase, oh, so-and-so... This woman is very Rubenesque because of the French artist Rubin, who the women he drew were beautiful, but by today's standards, they would need to lose, you know, 20 or 30 pounds.
Well, that's the subjective part of beauty, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah. That's the cultural part.
Yeah. And, you know, it's not, but I don't think it's just cultural. I think it might get back to what we started out talking about with music and how music has changed. And I think the reason why we have tended in recent decades to see Rubenesque women less as beautiful than the sort of anorexic, dare I say, or, you know, very, very thin.
The supermodels of today.
Supermodels of the past, say, 30 years.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm reading too much into this, but the thinner women are, the younger they tend to look.
Okay.
And I think our concept of beauty has been more reduced to simple sexual desires. And so when you see a woman who's young, you're thinking she can bear children.
Yes.
The older a woman is, you might be struck by that thought less and less. So younger, you think she's young, she's strong, she's healthy, she can bear children.
Well, she's basically at her prime when she's younger.
Physically.
Yeah, physically,
So what I think Rubenesque women were more like was maybe a woman who's had a few children, or...
Maybe, but I also think the single women were depicted as heavier, too, in his paintings, weren't they?
Yeah, but you know what else I think it had to do with was wealth.
Yes. No, you're right. Wealth was a good amount of weight was a sign of wealth. And
exactly.
That was a sign
this
of
is
being
a noble
the,
woman.
That was a sign of being in the upper echelons of society.
It's something desirable.
Right.
So a woman who was overweight and also pale meant she was not working in the fields.
Mm.
So
she didn't have to, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So there's different concepts of beauty. Like, for instance, you know, you look at the sort of sex symbols, what we would say today, right? These Hollywoods, they don't look like they're working in the field. You know, they don't look like they just came in from working in the field, right?
No, not at all.
Right. We have these.
Especially when they're on the red carpet. They didn't just come out from the field.
Right. Yeah, they're like these China dolls who just sit on the mantle for you to look at, right?
That's right.
And so there tends to be throughout the ages this appeal. Of course, I'm speaking as a man thinking of women, right? There's this appeal of... this preciousness, this delicateness, this tenderness, right?
Okay.
That would contrast with, say, a peasant woman who's always hunched over pulling weeds or something like that, right?
So getting back to the thinner versions of beauty that we have today.
Mm-hmm.
You reduce this to sexual beauty rather than personal beauty. Is that what I'm saying?
You mean aesthetically?
Yes.
I'm saying that's pure. Well, it's not purely aesthetic. If my hypothesis, if there's anything to it, that what we're thinking of is there's this sort of subconscious instinctive.
Yeah.
This is a fertile woman.
Right.
Let's say.
Now, would you say we've gone way too far with that? In as much as
absolutely.
Do you remember the iconic grandmother type who had gray hair up in a bun?
Right.
Glasses. Who rocked on a rocking chair?
Yeah.
You know, big
was knitting.
Big wide glasses and was knitting on her rocking chair.
Right.
Now
right.
this was probably back in those days. This is probably a woman in her 50s or 60s.
Yeah.
You know.
Right.
Today. All the way through your 80s, your hair is dyed black or whatever it is.
Right,
you're on a you know an exclusive diet. You're getting a little nip or a tuck here or there. You're trying to look as young as possible, even into your old age. So I think you have a point that we are way too much focused on
the beauty of youth,
the beauty of youth, and the fertility that goes with that, and we're pretending that we are that throughout the decades.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And we've lost the appreciation of the beauty of older people, right?
Yeah, it's very rare for anyone to consider a good plump 75-year-old woman without makeup and without dyed hair to be a beautiful woman.
Right. That is very rare.
Yeah. And sad.
Look at
all the all the newscasters you see today on television, for example. How many of them are 80-year-old plump, gray-haired women?
Yeah, they're not there anymore.
No. I don't know if they were ever
there. Were they ever there? Yeah.
But,
I mean, had Walter Cronkite, who was not a plump, gray-haired woman.
Certainly not now.
But,
now you have to hire models that are in their 20s or early 30s.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
978-454-4980. Kent, I've got something very beneath the surface after the break that I want to share with you about this question of beauty and how it relates to truth and goodness. First, this and then that. Don't go away. And we are back. You're listening to Beneath the Surface here at WCAP Radio. It looks like the streaming is back up, at least temporarily, which is good news, always. 978-454-4980 is our BTS hotline. Tonight's topic, we go beneath the surface on the meaning of beauty. What is beauty? Is it subjective or is it objective? My guest is Mr. Kent Niebuhr. And let me throw this at you, Kent. We talked earlier about how art is beautifully depicted when it depicts reality. And of course, music is a form of art. And I had mentioned earlier that there's something beautiful about a natural order. When it comes to music, audio consonance is beautiful. Tones, pitches go together well.
Harmony.
Certain ways. Now, I want to spell out slowly. I want to go beneath the surface with you on this to see if you see anything to this idea. With melody, melody is beautiful. Melody represents the individual, the beauty of the individual, somebody singing a melody. Harmony of interval, or a dyad, is beautiful, inasmuch as two notes go together perfectly. The dyad represents love, inasmuch as two notes go together perfectly and become one sound, the dyad. The harmonic triad, or the chord, the standard chord, represents life, inasmuch as you have three sounds that are actually one sound altogether. And the standard chord in music, we know, is three notes, like C, E, G, or D, F sharp, A. It's the chord D, the chord C. The chord G is G, B, and D. So you have three notes in one sound, and there's a beauty to this chord, to this consonance of the triad, the triadic sounds of a chord. There's a particular natural order that reflects the eternal Trinity himself, inasmuch as if a chord is three notes in one sound, so too is the Trinity three persons in one God. So to sum up, there's a natural order to music, inasmuch as melody reflects the individual person, dyadic harmony, or the interval, reflects love, or the two becoming one flesh, or marriage, you could say, and the triadic harmony, which is the standard musical chord, which has three notes and one sound, represents, you could say, the family. Mm. Mother, father, child, beloved, lover, beloved, love, which of course represents the Trinity himself, his Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And then one more thing, past the melody and the dyad and the chord, is the harmonic orchestra, inasmuch as this represents the beauty of community. Inasmuch as so many different things are doing their own thing within the one community of music, and yet it comes out as one piece of beauty, one piece of art. So there's a natural order to life, which is reflected in music, all of which is reflected in the divine eternal essence of God himself.
Which I think the argument that's been put forth even before Christianity, is that beauty is a representation, this is sort of where we started from, of what is transcendent, what transcends creation. And so if the beauty in creation is some manifestation of some aspect of God, then all of creation taken together would have this harmonious beauty that you talk about.
To it, reflecting like, its creator.
Right. Now, like, think of this. Say a beautiful mate. Here it is, fall in New England, right? And
yes.
The trees are turning colors. It's just imagine one of those beautiful maple trees that's so colorful.
It's breathtaking.
Right? But could that be in the middle of the Sahara Desert? No.
That's, no.
There's almost a dissonance, to use the audio analogy.
Right.
You put that in a field or in a forest.
Yeah, there's a certain logic to beauty.
In New England, it's harmonious.
Yes.
It's visually harmonious, let's say. Yeah. When things are taken out of their proper natural context, the beauty is at least compromised.
Yes. Yeah. It's imbalanced, like non-symmetrical, like we were talking about earlier.
Right. There's a certain inability to make sense of it.
Yes.
Right?
Exactly. Exactly. Reason is logical and it's consistent.
Right. You wouldn't see a maple tree floating through space.
Now, all of this, as we were saying, reflects the Creator himself.
Right.
Now, this also reflects St. Thomas Aquinas's fourth proof for the existence of God. Mm-hmm. And it goes something like this. We all evaluate things down here, things and people, in terms of their being more or less perfectly true, good, or beautiful, or so on. We all evaluate. We have those words, and they mean something to us. We have certain standards of how things and people should be, by virtue of their nature, their very nature. But we would have no such standards unless there was something that is perfection, mm-hmm. by which we judge the truth, goodness, and beauty of all things down here. And that standard, that infinite perfection himself must exist, which is God, of course, which Christians would call God, for us for the words truth, goodness, beauty, justice to have any meaning at all to us.
Right.
Now think about that, and mm-hmm. I want everyone to think about that. Those words have meaning to us. How and why do they have meaning to us? By what standard are we measuring this to have this degree of truth, goodness, or beauty in it? There
right.
must be a standard.
All cultures have a sense of these things.
Yes.
Right?
This is universal.
It's not just, well, we believe this because the dictionary says so.
This is a universal phenomenon in language and in thought.
The concept of truth, of beauty, of goodness, of friendship, of love, of freedom.
Of justice.
All these things, they ring in our souls. And so, therefore, there must be something common to all humans.
There must be a perfect standard by which we judge things down here, finite temporal things,
right.
to be true, good, or beautiful.
And we ourselves cannot be the source of it.
No.
Because it's universal. If it's universal, then it could not have been created among us.
Mm.
It had to come from outside of us. And not that it is imposed upon us. We are a product of it,
yes.
And so we recognize our origin, our source, our elements, you might say, as coming from outside of us and as being absolute, right?
Yes. In other words, there has to be absolute goodness, truth, and beauty for us to judge anything down here as having a degree of it. Because what are we judging it by?
And you say down here because it has to come from outside.
Yes.
Right? So even, and I don't just mean outside of me myself, I mean outside of creation, outside of the material universe.
Because there is no infinite standard of perfection here in the universe.
Exactly.
We are all finite creatures.
Right. We participate to one degree or another in that perfection, like we're kind of plugged into it. We tap into it, or we have tapped into it in some sense.
Mm.
However, we're not the source of it. For us to say, well, you know, think about how many times people would say something, well, that's not right.
Like,
that's just wrong.
Right.
What they're saying is that I can't articulate this, but I recognize it.
Yeah, there's something wrong about that.
Right.
Now, for those who are living in a post-Christian mentality, which a lot of people are, they would simply say that when people say that is wrong, they're actually just saying that is displeasing to me, subjectively.
Right. Relativistically.
Yeah, it's a relative thing. Now, you would say that's not true because truth, goodness, and beauty are both objective and universal, and it's something that's is not created by the individual.
Yeah, let's think of it this way.
Yeah.
There's a drug addict who's trying to come off drugs.
Okay.
And it involves a great deal of suffering, withdrawal, right? And we could say, well, that suffering he's going through is bad. He shouldn't go through that. Let's just give him a drink, or let's just give him some heroin, or let's just do it because it's bad that he's suffering.
Okay.
Right? He would say subjectively, this is a bad thing that's happening to me.
Yeah, I'm experiencing something very bad. Yeah.
But in reality, it's a good thing because it's a purification.
Yes.
Right? It's restoring him to his nature.
Yeah, to optimal health. Yes.
Right. Now, if I say something like, you know, I don't like when I'm thinking of a child, I don't like that I have to go to school.
Yeah.
Right. What we're saying is that I don't get pleasure from it.
Yeah.
Now it's a different thing to say I don't get pleasure from this, and it's bad. And what we're tending to say in the past, say, generation or two or maybe three now, is exactly that. What's good is what gives you pleasure, and what's bad is what either deprives you of pleasure or causes pain.
Especially in the moral realm.
Especially
in the moral realm. We haven't
behavior
caught up to it yet on the medical realm, even though we might be going slowly in that direction. But the moral realm is something that we have made to be subjective and relative for selfish gain.
Sure. And people will say, well, it's wrong for you. If you don't like that, then it's wrong for you.
Yeah.
But to be precise, we should really say, if you don't like that, you don't like it.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean it's right or wrong necessarily.
And you're saying comes with, in a sense, a sacrificial cost.
Yeah.
Because if truth, goodness, and beauty are independent of our likes and dislikes, if they're independent of our perceptions and thoughts and opinions, if they are objective, that means we need to conform to them in order for us to be happy.
You know, one of the things that I confronted in my conversion, I was not raised religiously. I became an actual sort of conscious atheist and then ended up being a Catholic. And one of the, it kind of, part of me was rejoicing at what I was discovering, but part of me was resisting it because it looked very difficult. And I was going to have to make some radical changes. Even though I wanted to make the changes, I was resistant because of the difficulty involved and the consequences in my life, in my world, so to speak. But ultimately, what compelled me to continue to move forward to the Catholic faith and being a member of the Catholic Church, becoming a Catholic, was I realized that it doesn't matter whether it's pleasurable or not. It matters that it's true. Because if I'm not living the truth, I'm living a lie.
And so if you're not living the truth, you're not living what is good for you.
Life is going to get ugly.
See, truth and goodness are
right.
So, and you're not living the beautiful life.
Right. My life will not be beautiful if I'm living a lie. Therefore, I want to live the truth, regardless of how much suffering it involves.
And this you would call the moral life.
Right.
The moral life,
right.
Becoming a better person, a more virtuous person, takes suffering. It takes at least sacrifice of your immediate pleasurable desires.
Even in a very mundane way, we think we look up to people we call heroes, and generally heroes are people who endure suffering and sacrifice for the good of others, right? We look up to these people. We admire them for their suffering.
Now go back to the orchestra example that I gave a little while ago.
Yeah.
Sometimes during a song, the drummer has to be silent, or the trumpet or the violinist has to do something that the violinist doesn't particularly like to do.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things, every single person in the orchestra is sacrificing for the good of the whole. And because they're doing that, the whole is beautiful.
Right.
Now, if we see ourselves as a human community, family and community, then if we're not doing that, we're not going to be living the beautiful life.
And I think implicit in what you're saying is the virtue of humility. If you always have to be front and center, have the solo, right? Everyone is looking at you. You're the loudest thing in the band or the orchestra or whatever. If that's where you are, you lack humility. And we might admire the talent of these people. Mm. We might wish we had their talent. We might.
But we don't like them.
But we don't like these people, right?
It makes sense.
Right?
Yeah, we don't like that about them anyway.
And I always think of at least people of my generation and older. Yeah. If you think of, say, who is the most beautiful person you've ever met through and through, just wonderful and kind and gentle and loving and warm and peaceful. And
I get it. All these things. Yeah.
We think of our grandmothers.
Often.
And I wonder if that's getting lost because of our shallow understanding of beauty.
One last quick question as we hear the music. In our culture that overemphasizes radical individualism, can we appreciate beauty in that milieu?
It's really hard to appreciate beauty without community.
Yes.
Right?
And without love.
Without love, right? Because community implies love. There are human bonds.
Yes. Mr. Kent,
thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for listening. Cindy's Vinyl Vault is up next. You've been listening to Beneath the Surface. I'm Paul Morano. Have a great week, and have a beautiful week and a beautiful life.
Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.